Welcome to JW Podcast, the Watchtower Jenga of podcasts that takes down the organisation one brick at a time.
Hello and welcome to JW Podcast. I have my boys with me today and I'd just like to say that nobody respects men more than I do. Neil, how are you?
That's so funny. I hear huge respecter of men, I'm doing very well, thank you. I just had an operation, had my gallbladder out because of my my pure Western diet, so I'm going to struggle along and do my best tonight.
Oh, Neil, I appreciate that. And Neil, I'd just like to clarify, I've never grabbed you by anything, have I?
Well, that's what you say, but the lawsuit will say different.
So, Neil, literally, you've come out of hospital to do the podcast, haven't you?
I have. I got out last night, and I'm ready to go. I'm rocking. Here we go.
I'm so appreciative of that. Every time I do a podcast, somebody's had some terrible thing happen to them. I feel like I'm the kiss of death to my co-presenters.
No, you know what it was? It was all the chocolate and fatty food. 20 years fat diet.
I'm due one, Sue, then.
I'd imagine so.
We can't find Billiam Bilford, who lives in the future down under. We've tried to get him and he's just not there. We think he's just having such a good time celebrating, I don't know, Australia Day, Thanksgiving for Australia, pre-Christmas, post-birthday, something. But until then, we've got John Viney. Hey John, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks Louise, and I'm very pleased to be on eventually.
Oh.
Now I've sorted all the bugs of the computer out and Skype and everything else.
John!
I finally made it.
You're the clearest guest I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, probably the nearest guest, aren't
I? The nearest.
I'm not that far.
Well, I'd like to say that, but me and Heather did have a young man in our bedroom for an interview a podcast ago, so I can't say you're the nearest, but you might be thankful.
All right.
You might be thankful for that. So where are you, John?
I'm separated from you now by the Bristol Channel, because although I live in Barry in South Wales, I brought my wife to Barnstable in Devon, where we are staying in a hotel. So it had to be a hotel that had Wi-Fi and good Wi-Fi so I could settle down for this interview. Oh. So we come down to, in fact, we were at Okehampton today.
There's a big prison there, isn't there?
Dartmoor.
Is it still open?
It is open, funnily enough, although it is closing. And I know that because I do voluntary work in prisons. So, and I stress it's voluntary and I can get out. Dartmoor is definitely closing. It's in a terrible state. I did a visit there about 2 years ago and part of the one wing is, you know, completely falling down. So, but it's all owned by the Prince of Wales. And I think they pay a very small fee, something like £1 a year for it.
Really?
So it's a piece of land that's owned by the Crown, I think. But yeah, so I'm in Barnstable and I'm in a small hotel here, and as long as you don't tell anyone, Louise and Neil, I'm actually doing a mystery shop. So I'm staying here as a mystery guest, and I have to mark the standards of everything. So I won't tell you where it is, but it's a small hotel, and we had to have a meal tonight. We've got breakfast tomorrow, had a drink, just one drink. After we finish this broadcast, I'm going to have to knuckle down and start writing a report about our stay.
In the
hotel. That's where we are.
I did not believe they existed. You're the
What's
first
that?
Mystery shopper I've ever heard of.
Really?
Mystery shopper. I thought it was one of those things you see online where they say, would you like to go and get free stuff? Just sign on for this. I thought to myself, no, it can't actually exist anymore. It must have been a con. But no, apparently it's real.
Oh, it's very real. So I can tell you, Neil, that although I've been window cleaning for 40-odd years, for the last 15, I've been a mystery shopper.
Well, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and for a period of about 7 years, I don't want to bore you with mystery shop stories, but
continue.
For about 7 years, I was doing upper-class Virgin flights all over the world. Yeah, so I used to have to go down mainly to London, to Heathrow or Gatwick, check into the lounge, which was a fantastic lounge. I mean, I could spend an hour talking about the Virgin Lounge. You have your shoes polished, then you have your hair cut, a massage, three-course meal, wine, whatever you wanted. And then, of course, you got on the plane. And in fact, I went over to Australia twice as a mystery shopper. I've been to Antigua, Barbados, China, India. So if you want to stay there, basically you've got to pay to stay, but they give you the flight. But we are talking about flights that are a couple of thousand pounds at least. So yeah, it was a great thrill to do that. And of course, that was the peak, if you like. For 15 years or so, I've been doing hotels, restaurants, you name it, it can be mystery shopped.
Wow.
Old people's homes.
And that all just fell through from your window cleaning, did it?
No, I actually answered an advert in the Magistrate magazine, because I serve as a magistrate as well, and I've done for about 10 years now. And the first month I became a magistrate, part of the Magistrates Association, I received their magazine. And in the magazine was an advert for mystery shoppers. So I didn't realise or know anything about it. But I read up on it and signed up. And I always remember being in London at a funeral when the phone went, and it was my first assignment. And they said, would I mind going to buy a Ferrari? So my first assignment was to pretend to be a customer to go and buy a Ferrari. That was in Cardiff. You don't actually hand over the thousands of pounds. You just pretend. But you have to be a really good actor, really. And you have to, you have to play the part of either a rich or a poor or whatever in between.
I can do poor very well.
I've done poor all my life. But it's been fascinating and still is fascinating. So it's one of those things that perks up life in between the drudgery of going up and down ladders for window cleaning.
That's epic. Well, John, you know, we haven't even started the interview yet, and we're utterly riveted by your mystery magistrate machinations.
The magistrate, that was really interesting, because I was still a JW.
Yeah, you were allowed to do that. Are you allowed to be part of Caesar's evil Caesar-ness?
Well, if I tell you, Louise, it's a matter of conscience. Is that okay?
Yeah. Is smoking a matter of conscience?
It depends what you're lighting, I suppose.
Incense sticks, John, incense sticks.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I've always been interested in the law, but I've got no brains at all, none at all. But I used to, even on wet, rainy window cleaning days, I would go and sit in law courts and listen to cases. Just because of being interested in it. And then one day I was speaking to a friend of mine who was a magistrate. Well, in fact, I didn't know he was a magistrate until he said to me that he was a magistrate. And I said, oh, where did you get your law degree then? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, to be a magistrate. And he said, oh, no, he said, you don't need to have a law degree. You just have to be an upstanding member of the public and no criminal record and have some common sense, and then you can apply. It's an amazing voluntary post where you can send people to prison for up to 6 months. or as one American colleague of mine said once, you mean you send people to prison as a hobby? But I did write to the society after I was appointed. I thought, I'm going to stick to my guns. I'm going to do this. And it took me about 18 months to get appointed through two interviews and everything. And then I wrote and said, I wonder what the views are of someone being a magistrate. I still got the letter actually back, because the first paragraph basically said, well, if you've got free time on your hand as a volunteer, you should be out preaching. Well, I was out preaching already. And then they mentioned that there may be some things that conscientiously you might not want to decide on. And I couldn't come up with anything. And haven't done in 14 years as a magistrate. I have never been faced with anything that I thought, I don't think conscientiously I could take part in this. Or not take part. But the other thing, of course, is as a magistrate, if for some reason you ever know anyone who comes before you, and there was a Jehovah's Witness once that came into court as a criminal, you just step back anyway. You can just actually sit back. They call it sitting back, and you don't take part in it anyway. So for 14 years, I would say my mystery shopping and my magistracy work has kept me sane from all of the other goings on that have been. It has absolutely been fascinating to be part of it. And I don't want to sort of brag now, but recently I was appointed on what they call the Lord Chancellor's Advisory Committee. So now I actually interview people to become magistrates.
Oh, amazing.
And recommend them to the Lord Chancellor. So it's a great privilege, honestly. I absolutely love it. So most of the week I'm window cleaning. And the rest of the week, I'm possibly sending people to prison.
Well, actually, I need to talk to you about that, because about 4 days ago, I was in the shop buying some chocolate, and I saw on the front page of the Gloucester Citizen a man who'd gone like, I'd taken some, I don't know, sleeping tablets or something and committed a burglary. I saw it on Facebook. It was a Jehovah's Witness from the Gloucester area. And it said, oh, he'd taken some tablets that he didn't think were working from the doctors, so he'd accidentally taken an overdose. And while he was zonked out, he'd committed a burglary. But then it said he had 3 previous convictions for burglary. He was a Polish guy in Lydney. So I thought, oh, I get that, right? He used to be a burglar. He'd converted to being a Jobo. But the first thing that happened when he didn't know what was happening, when he took too many tablets... Not that he thought, oh, I'll do the washing up, or oh, I'll mow the lawn, or
go out in the ministry,
or go out in the ministry, or I'll wash all the sheets and the pillowcases. No, his subconscious said, I'll commit a burglary. So he committed a burglary while he was under the influence of his tablets, and then he'd gone into a police station and gone, oh, I think I've committed a burglary. But because he'd been so honest, the judge said, oh, well, you can only have, I don't know, so many months in prison. But I did think, you know, his subconscious said, while you're not conscious, why don't you commit a burglary? Instead of, while you're not conscious, why don't you just lay down and have a little sleep? Or why don't you vacuum up the stairs? Or why don't you groom the dog or something?
Yeah, I did see that on Facebook. That was quite interesting.
Wasn't it?
But he gave himself up, didn't he?
Yeah, he did give himself up.
Yeah.
Consciously.
Didn't a couple of witnesses go in with him or speak up for him or something as well?
I don't know. Which, I don't know. He looked a right wrong one, though. Did you see his picture?
Yeah. Yeah. But have you seen my passport photo?
I know you're not allowed to think that as a magistrate. Oh, he looks a wrong one. But I am.
No, that's it.
I'm a member of the public, and I thought his eyes are too close together. His hairline's too far back. He looks a proper wrong one. But here's the other thing I thought, actually. Burglar, converted to a religion, chooses the religion where you get to go around and knock on people's doors, like casing out houses. Is that not like... Ooh, I don't know. Like a chocoholic visiting chocolate factories.
Encasing the joints as she goes round.
Yeah, I just thought, it's, you know, could he not have joined the Church of England where they just have cups of tea?
that reminds me of a prison story involving a Jehovah's Witness. I don't know if you want me to...
Oh, please do.
Well, it's a strange one, this, because about... Oh, I am going back many, many years, but there was a young sister that was seeing a young brother in a local congregation to me, and the father didn't approve. That's the father of the young lady. And the father was an elder, and the brother didn't desist and kept meeting the girl, I think, quietly and privately. And eventually the dad found out, this elder, and literally got an axe. And remember, he's an elder. He got an axe, went to the apartments where this young brother lived, smashed through the front door with the axe, and was going to kill the brother. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But the brother, this is the elder coming through the door now with an axe. The young brother was in the flat, 3 stories up, saw the brother coming in, ran to his balcony, hung from the balcony, and dropped 3 floors and got away. So, well, as you do. This is absolutely true, I'm telling you. The brother did get removed as an elder, I should say. But but guess what? Guess what he's doing now, that brother, that elder? He's visiting, he's one of the prison visitors as an elder. He was reappointed and he's now visiting people who want to be Jehovah's Witnesses in prison, when he should have actually been in prison himself.
But in what respect was the boy seeing the girl, like seeing her in a Christian way?
I don't think there was any evidence of a hokey pokey. No, seeing her in the right way. But the father said, I don't want you seeing my daughter. You're not to see my daughter. So that was a bit of a notorious case.
Was that Wales?
In South Wales that was, yeah. But it's funny, it's just so funny that now the brother, who's now an elder again, has now had an assignment to go and visit prisoners.
It's very narcissistic that the father felt that because the daughter wasn't doing exactly what he wanted her to, not seeing the person that he wanted her, that he could get an axe and sort it all out. Do you not think? It's very controlling, that, isn't it?
Well, I would say so. It's definitely not in the reasoning book, I don't think. It's under A for axe.
A for axe. Because my daughter's nearly 19, and, you know, there might be boys that she goes out with I don't like, but at no point do I think I have the permission to axe anyone's house who I don't like a seeing. I just think, oh, I wouldn't go out with him. It's not my life.
Well, you do just wonder what would have happened had the young lad not been able to drop three floors and get away. You just dread to think what would have happened, because he literally smashed through the front door with the axe.
They were in the same congregation, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that makes the Sunday meeting awkward, doesn't it?
I think the boyfriend is off the scene now. That was a long time ago. It makes a new saying to meet the in-laws. It's a you wouldn't really want to meet those sort of in-laws, would you?
When I was going out with my ex-husband, when we were boyfriend and girlfriend and we were both Jehovah's Witnesses, and I'd left my hometown and moved 200 miles away to Southampton. So I was fair game in the eyes of all the male narcissists who wanted women to control, because I was an 18-year-old girl living in a bedsit 200 miles away from home. So they were all salivating over who could claim paternal rights over me to tell me what to do. And as it happened, I went out with my ex-husband, and his dad kind of claimed rights over me. And I remember being round their house one day, and, you know, like when you sit on a sofa and I don't know. You tuck your legs up under your skirt because you don't sit up properly. And later his dad said to my fiancé at the time, I could see right up her skirt to her knickers. And I said, well, it shouldn't have been looking up my skirt at my knickers. But obviously I was only 18 and he was an adult, and I felt deeply ashamed. And the whole situation was crook. But when you're 18, you don't say that, do you? Just like you're suffused with guilt and shame and disgust and self-loathing at it. And actually, I'd done nothing really except have a skirt on and sit on the sofa.
Yeah. And most other people, you've been allowed to wear jeans.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. I remember being summoned to see an elder. It was my ex-husband's sister's husband's dad, who was an elder. Do you know how all incest, John knows this, everybody's related to everybody, and everybody on the body of elders are all related to everybody else, aren't they?
So it was one of them situations.
So this hideous old repulsive elder who was related thrice removed by incest to my ex-husband summons us for some kind of ticking off. And I rocked up in a pair of jeans that had ripped knees. And his first edict was how disgusting it was that I turned up so shamelessly in ripped jeans, and how disrespectful it was. But again, I was suffused with self-loathing and guilt and shame. And actually, I was a really quite a good girl. But I wasn't.
He didn't even get a chance to know you.
No, he didn't even get a chance to know me.
Hey, John, did you know any elders over in my part of the world?
No, I don't. I can't say as I know any. When I was about 16, I can remember. I'm not sure where you are, Neil.
Just outside Belfast.
Right. Well, when I was about 16 and pioneering as a good lad, we went hitchhiking round Ireland. And it was fantastic. I had a great time. So we did meet quite a few people, but I am going back many, many years. There were some interesting experiences I remember we had up in Ballymena and around the North Antrim coast and right round to Donegal. Yeah, oh, it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. And I was camping. I literally had one of these, well, it was a little tent. But in those days, little tents were made of canvas, so they were like big tents. And just hitchhiking round, putting that up every night. But we met some interesting people. And once I remember we camped in a nunnery, grounds of a nunnery, because the nuns came out, because I couldn't get a lift. I was trying to get a lift, and I couldn't get a lift. So I asked if I could put my tent up. And they said, have you prayed for a lift? Have you prayed? And I said, yeah, I've done a lot of praying, but I'm afraid I'm all out of lifts tonight. So can I just put the tent up? I remember getting told off, Neil, by a circuit overseer over there. So that's my mum one memory. Yeah. I don't know whether...
What did you do wrong?
I left a note. We used to play with words of scriptures in those days. We left a note for a special pioneer couple who had put us up, and we'd moved on, but the note was on the table, and they were having the circuit overseer at the time, and the note we left was a misquote from a scripture. We said that the wages sin pays are death, but the hours are good. when we got back a week later, we told that the circuit overseer was not amused.
Like the Queen.
How long are you out of the witnesses now?
I've not been active. I think, do you know, time just seems to go. It's about 10 years now. It's about 10 years.
Quite a while.
So, but I was in when I was five. My mum and dad became Jehovah's Witnesses when I was five. And I'm almost 65. So for about 55 years I was active, which is, like many others, it's a very long time to be in what I now know as a cult, and very, very difficult to get free of.
Fortunately, yeah, you're right.
Tell us about Mary, because she's lovely. Everybody loves Mary.
My wife, she's currently asleep on the bed at the moment. Aww. So I'll talk low about her.
Yeah.
she, as I can tell you, as a Jehovah's Witness, you would not have got a more genuine believer. Studied, she did personal study, she did absolutely everything that you would think a Jehovah's Witness should, a genuine person should do, and she did. And so even when 10 years ago I had to stop, and I use that expression because I did have to, I would probably have had a mental breakdown if I hadn't, but she was very supportive of me, and I was of her. I mean, we still used to take her to the meetings and pick her up afterwards and things like that. So, and I never ever set out to denigrate JWs in front of her. In fact, it was the governing body and the local Jehovah's Witnesses that completely messed up and caused her to take a look. And I think along with my sister Alison Boniface, that used to show Mary a few things from the internet, my wife Mary completely saw through it. I mean, even more than I ever did, and has probably gone further away than I have. Mm. So she's going through a very angry stage at the moment, and has been. She's nearly a year stopped. But you can't mention that without mentioning the fact that my daughter, 25 years ago, was abused. Mm. So we've been through all that. We've had court cases, and we've had circuit overseers telling us one thing and then doing another. We've had elders telling us one thing and then doing another. We've had the society itself telling us one thing and doing another. So she has seen all that, and they have done it. It wasn't doctrinal. She hasn't been looking at apostate internet stuff. It's been what Jehovah's Witnesses have done has turned her away. And you know what? I can honestly say, I've been married 44 years now. And this last year has probably been the happiest we've ever been in all of our lives. Oh. I can't describe it. It's like living with a different lady.
I'm so pleased.
But better. I'm not kidding. It's an amazing thing that anyone who thinks that being a Jehovah's Witness makes you a better person. I don't want to castigate everyone who's a Jehovah's Witness, because that wouldn't be true either. But I can honestly say that... leaving and not having all of that pressure has been one of the best things that could have ever happened.
I fondly call her Angry Mary, but out of love, because I really like her. But she does make me laugh because she's so angry. But I first met her at Alison's house, I think about a year ago, and it was when Lloyd came over, wasn't it? And I felt so sorry for her because she wasn't fully out, but she'd come to Alison's house and there was me there and you there and Lloyd and Mark and Cora and the scariest apostates that you could ever think of, and Mary, who wasn't out yet. And I remember us all being very, very careful around her because nobody wanted to upset her or subvert her faith, and we were all tiptoeing around her. And I just thought, what a brave thing to do, to come to this evening and spend this time with these people who are like, it must have been like, you know, spending time with demons from her point of view. But soon after, she came out, and I know she'll get past the anger, but she's got a lot of justifiable anger at what's happened to your family.
Well, do you know what? Quite a funny thing was, about 2 years ago, when my daughter Karen and myself took part in, I think it was the Channel 4 documentary, or a programme about Karen's abuse, and they asked if they could film our house. And Mary said, oh, no, please don't. I don't want you to be filming in our house. Well, but we couldn't go around to Karen's house because she got two big Alsatian dogs. And every time anyone went by, the dogs would be barking and it would spoil the filming. So we ended up having to come around to our house. So we were in the front room, our big front room. And Mary, as a very hospitable person, offered a cup of coffee. And she was coming in. It was like pre-filming. Or I should say during filming, that they had stopped. And they suddenly said, oh, would you mind if we just took a film of you just bringing the coffee in? And she said, no, that's okay. So there's a little clip on this Channel 4 programme. You just see Mary walking in with a cup of coffee and putting the tray down. Did you? Well, she did not get into trouble over that at congregation.
Really?
Because one of the elders asked to work with her in the ministry. And when he was on his own with her, he said, where does your loyalty lie? Where does your loyalty lie? I'm not kidding. This is exactly what he said. And she hadn't said a word. She didn't even want to do it. But all she did was brought the coffee into this film crew. And that's the sort of thing. I mean, they do the damage themselves. Mm-hmm. They just haven't got a clue about loving and kindness. Nothing like, oh, what a shame of what you've been through.
No, how awful that your daughter.
Nothing to do with what's happened to you, and what a shame that your husband, who was, you know, it was an elder, is now not anymore. How are you coping? It was just, where does your loyalties lie?
And of course, loyalty only goes one way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Doesn't it, Neil? Yeah, it does.
I mean, we've all got these same terrible stories, or, you know, or reflections of the same stories. And then when it comes to it, when there was a make or break point, the Jehovah's Witnesses just went, okay, you know what, clear off.
Yes, you're right, Neil. That's what completely done it in a way with me. If following the court case, which lasted 3 weeks, where my daughter was abused 25 odd years ago, it was only like two and a bit years ago that he went to court. It lasted 3 weeks. He was found guilty and sentenced to 14 years. Now, at the court, what was strange was the society, via the circuit overseer, had asked two independent elders to attend court on every day. And I happened to know them anyway, but they let it be known to me that, look, we can't be seen talking to you. We're independent. We're just here to observe and to report back. So for the first week, court went through as normal. Witnesses were called, but each day we met outside in the waiting room. These two elders got closer and closer to us, you know, first of all just saying hello, then asking how we were. And by the end of the first week, they were sitting with us. By the end of the second week, we were all going out for breakfast together because they said they could see that this man was guilty. They told us they could see he was guilty. The evidence was obvious. But what they said was that they'd been asked to conduct an investigation, and as soon as the court would have finished, they would be taking the lead in interviewing all of the Jehovah's Witnesses or ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, including those that were disfellowshipped, to get to the bottom of this case. And when I met the circuit overseer, he said the same thing. He said to me, John, these are his very words, John, the society are really interested in this case. I can assure you no stone is going to be left unturned to get to the bottom of. And then, of course, a couple of weeks later, he gets sentenced to 14 years. And suddenly, every Jehovah's Witness gets pulled from it, completely pulled. We can't get hold of them. We're expecting them to come and see us, to do interviews. It took me a year to get hold of the circuit overseer. I did get hold of the circuit overseer. I met him outside the Kingdom Hall. And I said to him, you told me no stone will be left unturned. What's happened? And he said, oh, we've just been pulled, John. We've just been pulled. And so they had no intention of getting to the bottom of it. I think they were probably worried about, oh, if this goes sour, I wonder what we're going to do. I don't know. But why otherwise would you let people down like that? And that sort of thing did damage to my wife, Mary, as well.
But John, at what bottom was there to get to? If somebody's been through the British justice system, which is an old and a mature legal system, and they've found somebody guilty through due process of law, what other bottom is there? What's the other bottom that the society needed to get to?
Well, I can only assume that, of course, spiritually, they would be looking at what should be done to the individual concerned. I mean, I don't know. Technically, there were four victims in this case. Mm. Two were adults and two were children. One was a rape, an alleged rape, which proved to be a true rape in the court case. One was a sexual assault at work on a non-Jehovah's Witness, yes, while he was disfellowshipped. And two younger children who were abused. So you've got four witnesses. Well, even by Jehovah's Witness rules, you've got more than you need
exactly
to deal with someone.
Was it true that you went round and asked other victims who were current Jehovah's Witnesses to come forward?
Well, because I knew 20-odd years ago this man's conduct was being spoken about. And so, yes, even 20-odd years ago, I made it my business to go and ask individuals, has there any approaches been made? Have you been touched inappropriately? And at that time, we found that there were others, not perhaps of the worst sexual nature, but there was other bad behaviour. But more recently, in a different congregation, but nearby, he had also inappropriately touched people there. But of course, they're all active witnesses. None of them wanted to come forward. None of them wanted to cause a scene or make a fuss. So it was very difficult. And of course, one of the worst things ever was 25 years ago. Well, I suppose all hell broke loose. That's the best way of describing it. In our congregation, all hell broke loose. We had an elders, a body of elders. And again, I don't want to bore your listeners, Louise, with this, but if I described an elders meeting to you, we had there will be elders or ex-elders listening to this who will be saying, oh, he's making this up, this can't never have been true. But I can assure you it absolutely was. We had about 15 elders, mostly related, as you described earlier, mm-hmm. Louise.
Yeah.
And what set the whole thing off was a young brother and a young sister got up to something. And the young brother happened to be a ministerial servant and a pioneer, but he also had brothers who were elders and father as an elder. And when we looked into the conduct of this young man, it was obviously conduct that needed handling, because I was the Jehovah's Witness then. And we had an elders meeting to discuss it, and their starting point was, we're not going to do anything to this brother. That was their starting point.
Because
he was the son of an elder and brothers of, and I couldn't believe it. It was the first time ever I had ever known, obviously, a miscarriage of justice, if you like, in the body of elders. And we had comments from one elder who said, well, King David was immoral, wasn't he? He didn't get removed, did he?
Oh, Angie.
Now, if anyone else in the congregation and had done, other previous people had been immoral, it was handled. So this had never happened before until it happened to this person who was related to everyone. Another chump elder said, "Well, boys will be boys."
No.
I can still remember these comments, honestly. You wouldn't believe it. And they decided that he's not going to be taken off. But what we're going to do is we're going to say he can't go on the platform. He can't give talks. He can't say prayers. He can't take part in anything in the Kingdom Hall. But he's going to stay as a ministerial servant and as an elder, which to those Jehovah's Witnesses or ex-Jehovah's Witnesses listening will know that that's a crazy, crazy situation. So that night, I rang the circuit overseer and said, "Look, I've just got to tell you this situation has happened." And he said, "Well, look, one of us is going to have to write to the society and it'll be better coming from you." So I stayed up all night writing this letter, just stating the facts. There was no names mentioned. And the next day, we had an elders meeting after the general meeting on a Thursday night, and I had to gave a copy of my letter to the presiding overseer. And that is when all hell broke loose, because he called up an elders meeting, read my letter out to them, and they would have run me out of town and stoned me, I think, honestly. In fact, the guy that's in prison for 14 years, I remember him standing up and pointing at me and saying, "What are we going to do with this disloyal man?" And I can tell you that for a year we had non-stop debates. I mean, it was the most terrible, unscriptural, unspiritual time you would ever want to be with anyone.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned at the start when you were telling us about that was the first time that you had seen, I think you said, things were done wrongly.
Yes.
Or injustice.
Yeah.
I was never an elder or a ministerial servant. Most any was a regular auxiliary pioneer. But I'm pretty sure Louise would agree with me. But from the outside looking in, I seldom saw any justice in any decision. I mean, as someone who was, you know, in my Kingdom Hall and Kingdom Halls around me, every single circuit overseer's visit was an opportunity for some family to make a plea to them. To that man for justice for something that was not being done correctly, and then it was ignored most of the time. So I'm trying to see how that fits in with your experience, because you couldn't have been in the only Kingdom Hall where they did things correctly. You know, even if you accept correctly by the Jehovah's Witness standards.
Yes, I understand. Yeah,
Jehovah's Witnesses are wrong on the face of it, but they even break their own rules. And I, you know, until I left at 25 and I was capable of understanding what they were doing, I never saw them behaving in a way that I thought was correct, even for Jehovah's Witnesses.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm sure you're right, Neil. I would have to say that I lived it. I believed it. I did everything right. I'm going to sound like a real goody-goody here, aren't I? But we did, as a family, we did everything you're supposed to do. When my daughter's gone into trouble, I think one of them smoked or there's something, just a one or two cigarettes. When they did anything like that, within an hour, I was at the house of the presiding overseer knocking on his door saying, "You need to know this." And I thought all elders did that with their children. I thought all elders' families did.
Well, no, we did. Our family did. I mean, my sister was assaulted by a boyfriend and she was disfellowshipped for it.
Yeah.
She was sorry. Your sister was disfellowshipped for being assaulted.
Yeah, she was assaulted by her first boyfriend.
Misogynist.
Yeah, he's still a witness. He's still a witness down south. And he was her first boyfriend. He assaulted her. It came out because obviously these things do. And she was about 16, 17. The elders took them both. They were both disfellowshipped. He was for 6 months. She wasn't deemed repentant enough for, you know, the crime she committed. Well, I lost my sister when I was 12 years old, and I spoke to her again the week I quit Jehovah's Witnesses at 25.
You obviously can name, I'm sure there are lots and lots of examples, but I can honestly say that within the body of elders, that when I was an elder, I don't know what was going on elsewhere. Mm. All I'm saying is that up until that point, I never saw any what I would call irregularities. There probably were. I never saw them. so blatant as when this happened in the congregation where I was an elder. And for that year, well, eventually what happened was, it's actually too involved to go into. It's so difficult because one of the individuals that was causing the problems ended up being my brother-in-law, who is the one that's in prison for 14 years. When the letter came back removing him as an elder, and this is before he was disfellowshipped, his conduct was then subject to scrutiny. They found, this is pre-rape, pre-sexual abuse, his conduct in general was not good. So he was removed. But the letter came back from the society saying he's to be removed. Members of the family went to the presiding overseer, fellow elders, to say, don't read that letter out. So they're trying to interfere. And eventually what had to happen was a 7-man committee had to come and spend a week in our congregation. It was formed of 2 district overseers, 1 circuit overseer, and a 4-man special committee from the circuit. And they spent the week with us and tried to get to the bottom of what was going on. Eventually, several people were removed, as you could probably imagine.
Just not him.
And that, no. That just did a lot of damage. And it's strange how you live with that. So I've lived with that. And I sometimes relive it. I mean, this is very sad, really. But I do relive it because I remember what was said, who said what. And in fact, when I was giving evidence in court at my daughter's trial, I used an expression which just came out of nowhere, but the reporters got hold of it and used it as a headline in the local paper. I think I said something like, in those days, that body of elders was spiritually bankrupt and morally corrupt, and that became the headline. And I can honestly say that they were. But I would like to say that things have got better. But when you think that a young lady that has to go to court to defend herself, which my daughter had to now 25 years later, and she goes back and appeals to that seven-man committee, and she appeals to those other elders that knew what went on and asked them to come to court just to give evidence, not to say that that happened to her, because they can't say that, but to say that, yes, we did actually have to have all those meetings. Because what there was a fear of was that this my brother-in-law was making up the story that, oh, these 4 victims got together last year and made this up. You know, they're ex-witnesses. They've got something to they want to cause trouble.
They've got an agenda. Yeah, they're making it up.
They're making it up.
How coincidental that they've all come out together now, so many years later. Why didn't they say something at the time when they were 9?
But the thing is, though, Louise, that works. If you don't get anyone coming forward from 25 years ago who is prepared to say, well, no, that's not the case, because we held meetings about it. She came to us 25 years ago and made these accusations. Yeah. But not one elder comes forward to support her just to give
just
evidence
to say,
that these things went on. So all they needed to say was, no, we did try and handle this 25 years ago, but it wasn't handled. So I'm afraid my respect for these people that I once had a tremendous amount of respect for has completely gone. I just don't believe you can trust them. And now what we know with this this theocratic warfare expression where they can legitimately tell lies as long as it protects the society or God, well, they're capable of anything now, aren't they? They are actually capable of anything, as we've seen more recently with other cases.
Now, was that at the congregation in Barry where I visited, where we couldn't find the postbox?
It was, yes.
Yeah,
that was where I was.
That was interesting, because I went into that hall. And you lent me a pen to record it, didn't you, which I've still got. It's an amazing little device. I didn't quite know what I was recording, but it was just switched on and I went into the hall. And what was interesting was I stood at the back for ages, and it was at the end of a Sunday meeting. So we'd said the finishing song, the finishing prayer, and I walked into the hall at the end, and it's the bit where everyone's mingling and having a chat, and obviously nobody's seen me before, and it wasn't a big hall, and nobody came up to me for like 15 minutes, which is a long time when you stood. Lucky you end up feeling like a bit of a plum. And I was stood thinking, you know, any minute now somebody will come up and go, oh, hello, can I help you, or is there something you want, or what the hell are you doing in our hall? You weren't here for the meeting or anything. And nobody came up, and I had to approach somebody in the end. And they, obviously, you saw it on the film, didn't you? They were so callous. And when I came out and I said, oh, you know, where's the post box? Nobody can post anything to you because nobody can find the post box. And the man came out. And I just said, can you tell me why Mark Sewell hasn't been disfellowshipped? And he just said no, and I said, you don't care, do you? And that was it. They just didn't, just in totally indifferent to it. It must have been a sore point for them, because as you say, John, they had circuit overseers there.
Well, to be honest, they did get a bit of a kick in. During the court case, it was headlines every day in sort of the South Wales Echo or the Western Mail or even the local Barry paper. So you drove down the town and you saw on the billboards outside the news agents, you could see Barry Elder does this, Barry Elder does that. So I think if I said I'm not a liked man in Barry by a lot of JWs, I think that's probably an understatement. But of course, I haven't done anything wrong.
I just happened
to be the father of.
But I presume they had his disgustable picture everywhere, did they?
Oh yeah, they had that. They had the picture. But you know, the other ironic thing was that in one of the quotes that I think it was the BBC contacted the presiding overseer in the paper. He was called the Barry spokesman. The ironic thing was they told the BBC that Mark Sewell is not known to us. That was the expression used. And when Alison, my sister...
He was in the body of elders!
I know, that's what I mean about the lying, you see. When my sister and I read that, we said, what do you mean that he's not known to them? That was one of the things
like
that
a mystery shopper.
Follow up on. Well, my sister actually telephoned the presiding overseer and said, did you tell them that you didn't know Mark Sewell and he wouldn't commit himself? But he actually said no. In fact, he did say, no, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
So she rang the BBC again, and the BBC said, look, we can't tell you who it was that told us, but it was whoever it is that speaks on the phone when you ring the Barry spokesman number.
Right, yeah.
So, and guess who it was? It was the same guy again. So this time Alison spoke to him and he admitted it. He said, yes, we did say that. So they actually lie. So we went to see the circuit overseer, my sister and myself, again to see the circuit overseer. Now, bearing in mind we don't go anymore, but we still went into the Kingdom Hall where we knew he was. We asked to see him. We had a meeting upstairs and he brought another elder in sort of as a witness with him. And it was all done very politely. And we just said, look, we want to know, why would you make a statement or why would someone make a statement that Mark Sewell is not known to us when his brother is still in the congregation, his mother-in-law is in the congregation, all the people he grew up with is in the congregation.
He's an elder.
And even
his dad's an elder.
Yeah. And even the brother that came in as a witness said, oh, he said, I saw that. I thought that was a bit funny as well. So we're not talking about something obscure here.
No.
And that was another promise that the circuit overseer, the same one, promised, look, I'll try and find out what's happened, why that was said. And we said, good, can we meet up again for you to find out? Because we thought, we're not going to leave this. Well, do you think we could ever get a meeting again to discuss it? No. So they're a pretty poor show, really. I think of the Bible, because I still hold some respect for the Bible. And I think what it says about how victims would be like, is it like a wick? I can't remember the scripture now. You'll have to forgive me. It's been about 12 years. Do you know the one where it says that you don't squash a reed?
Yeah.
You've got to sort of look after the victims.
Yeah.
Well, why don't they start doing that? Why not looking after some of these poor people? And of course, since what's happened to my daughter, I mean, there's been countless examples. And as you will know, Louise, I'm sure Neil as well, on Facebook, because there are some closed groups and some open groups of victims that are coming along now, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases all over the world. So it's an epidemic and it's not going to go away. They need to do something.
You think they will?
I think they will have to. It won't be because they see the light. I think they'll be made to by the government, I think. Or put it like this, I think it's going to cost them in their pocket. That seems to drive a lot of new light. You get new light when suddenly a Tuesday night meeting in the book study in a house can be vacated because we want to give you an for studying in your own homes. But what fun... Yeah. But it's not actually that. It's because you can't guarantee the behaviour of someone in someone's home, so they can have legal action against you. So there seems to be a legal move behind every piece of new light that comes to light.
That's very true. It was the same way with the donations, and we're now just giving away the magazines for free.
Yeah.
No, Neil. That was a loving blessing from Jehovah, so that more people could be saved before the end.
Absolutely. I'm so sorry. I'm being so cynical.
It was nothing to do with VAT.
Did you see this latest letter that's just come out about the magnetic notice board? I'm sorry to bring that up, Louise.
Oh, no, please tell me what's going on now.
I'm so sorry. Jehovah has lovingly blessed the congregations by introducing magnetic notice boards. I said, oh my God, wait till I tell them about paper clips.
Someone's obviously leaked these two letters online again, and they are genuine. One is to the congregation that reads a little bit like Louise just said, that, you know, God's blessing is now abundant again in that magnetic notice boards are going to appear, and people will be able to, you know, put their signs on and off without there being wear and tear and all that. So what a loving blessing and evidence of God's blessing. And then you read the elders' letter, the one that the elders have to discuss, is how are you going to pay for these things? Basically, we want your money. We can't this is not provided free. It's quite strange reading the elders' letter. It's more about money than it is about anything else.
It says, do not read this letter. This letter must not be read out to the congregation, but magnetic notice boards don't come from nowhere.
They don't grow on trees, you know.
They don't grow in Staples.
Jehovah has lovingly provided these. He's still not going to arrange for elderly people to get visits, but the magnetic notice boards will be very useful.
John, I've got to wind back a few years, because on Friday when I was driving home from work, it was the anniversary. It was the 50th anniversary of Aberfan.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Where the slurry pit slid down the hill and killed all those school children. And I know 50's no different to 49 or 48 or 47 years. It was a tragedy from day one, but somehow 50 resonates. But Mary said that you and her had gone and witnessed there in Aberfan.
Yeah, when I moved down to Wales when I was 17, I moved down to the next village, which was a village called Troyderoo. The next village is Aberfan. And I stayed with a special pioneer couple and another young lad who turned out to be my pioneer partner. And so our territory was Troyderoo, Aberfan, Merthyr Vale, and a few of the other areas there. And then, of course, I met Mary and we got married, and then we ended up moving to Troyderoo. So we used to walk to Aberfan regularly. Yes, we did have Bible studies with quite a few, or root calls, as we used to call them, taking the magazines regularly. And, of course, when you believe it, Louise, you know, you're in a different mindset, aren't you?
Of course, I totally get that. I'm not,
We were genuine in our message of we're going to hopefully help these people. Yeah, and I have to tell you, they were kindness itself, these people. They were distraught. I always used to hate these sort of stories. You know, sometimes you'd hear these stories where a bomb has gone off and it's blown a bus up, and a Jehovah's Witness just got off at the last stop. And thank goodness for that. Jehovah protected them. You know, that type of thing. Well, this special pioneer couple used to quite delight in telling the story that morning at 9 o'clock, they would have been working Moy Road in Aberfan where that happened. Yeah. But they were delayed and couldn't get there, and of course then that happened. I don't know, I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? What a crazy situation. But you're right, there's just no answer. If someone lost their faith after that incident, and never regained it, you couldn't blame them, could you?
So it happened in 1966, didn't it? When were you there?
Let me see. I left school in 1965. So 3 years later, 66, 67. About 68.
So very soon after.
And were there... not too long after. 68, 69. We got married in 1972. So we got married in 72. So I was there about 68, 69. And then in 1972, we were there together as a couple. Several, I think four survived the actual, that were in the school and actually survived. I'm pretty sure that's the case, yeah. There were certainly other children that were either of, you know, not quite old enough to get into that school. So because we're there now a couple of years later, we were seeing children who were just too young to go to that school. Yeah. So, yes, we saw children in Aberfan. We saw some of the family members, some of the younger children who had lost their older brother or sister. Yeah. And I can remember Mary this week saying, oh, let's go up to Aberfan and see if Mrs. So-and-so is still there, because we have one of them used to give us a meal, used to invite us in and give us a meal. So, as I say, we were sincere in what we were doing at the time. And the people, I mean, it knocked them for six. One of the magistrate colleagues I have now was just recently on the television, because he was one of the four that were pulled out. And there was pictures of him as an eight-year-old boy being one of the surviving children. He said he had a dead girl laying on his side for about two or three hours. With her eyes, he said, popping out. He said he couldn't do anything about it because he was pinned down. His name's Jeff. He was one of the survivors. Yeah, those people that survived did feel guilty, and I think they've carried that with them all.
I don't know if you heard the teacher who was like, I don't know.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was like a junior teacher at the time, wasn't she?
Yeah, and there was a teacher talking to the current children, and she was saying to them, you have all the future and the opportunities that those children didn't have. You can grow up, you can have children, you can get jobs, you can do all the things that those children didn't have. I just thought it was so interesting what Mary said. Because she said what you said, we went in all genuineness. We went and we sold them the resurrection hope, but we believed it. And you would, you would.
I mean, there's no doubt about it that if someone is a believer in the Bible, if they are, and they want to believe that God's going to resurrect, then that can be a comfort. I mean, it's I know it's an individual's decision. We of course missed the point anyway. What they seem to have focused on is the mothers, particularly. The mothers formed what they called the Young Wives Group. In fact, they were laughing about the name because I think it was recently they've changed it. They said, how can we get 60, 70, and 80 and 90-year-olds? How can we be young wives anymore? So they're just the wives now. But they've held that together, and they would meet regularly, and they said, I suppose it's a little bit, Louise, not as great, but it's a little bit like our survivors group. When an ex-JW starts to write their story, they don't really need to write much, because all of us say, we've got it. You don't have to say much. And I think in Aberfan, amongst the mums and the aunties and the dads, they could look at one another and very few words need to be said, because they knew. The mums I know have this support, have had it for 50 years, and they go out on trips and determined to enjoy life without forgetting their loved ones.
So you've had other experiences. You were part of the hospital liaison committee, weren't you, John?
Yeah, that was fascinating. It probably kept me going longer than anything else, you know. Because it was a diversion. I mean, I hate to say that, because I was absolutely genuine in my beliefs. And I thought, first of all, that if God has got a sense of humour, to pick me on it, to put me on a blood committee, because I never even used to read the Awake articles. You know, you get these Awake articles that come out, your wonderful heart or your amazing brain.
The one that told you how to bake bread. I cried when I read your article about how to bake bread. You didn't read that one.
No, I was never really interested in the human body. But so when in 1991 I was invited to be on the hospital liaison committee for Wales, it was the only one, the first one. and I became the chairman of it. So there were about seven of us. And we used to go all over Wales for about 5 years. I used to write to doctors all over the place. It consumed me. I won't deny it. It absolutely really? Consumed me. In that I was writing to doctors, trying to get them on our side, trying to find out whether they would be willing to do things mm-hmm. without blood. Were they already doing things without blood? Yeah. Did they know about Dr. Smith, who was already doing it? Could we send them an article about it? And we used to go and meet them. We used to give talks at hospitals. We used to go around lunchtime, give lunchtime lectures. So it was something that took up a lot of time. And I suppose we made a lot of friends within the hospital setting, in that we were able to put doctors in touch with other doctors that had done things without blood. So I felt, whether it's nothing to do with beliefs even, if you could help save a life by someone who's going to refuse blood, if you could actually say, well, look, there's someone that could actually work on them and save their lives, you'd rather that than denying blood. And one of the proudest things I can honestly say was, I don't know, Neil, whether you ever heard this, but it was about 10 years into the HLC. We were giving a lecture in Newport in South Wales, and we were talking about these cell saver machines, intraoperative blood salvage, they're called. It's where you get a machine yep. during the operation. It takes your blood that's lost in your body cavity and it reroutes it through a machine, cleans it, and then puts it back in. And during the question time, one of the doctors said, why don't you people pay for one? Yeah. We'll use it, but you provide it. And that was quite hard hitting. And so we had invited a circuit overseer to be in the audience that day. So having coffee later, we said to him, look, the doctor's got a point. We're asking these doctors to not use blood. If there are machines around that can help, why don't we set up a fund? And of course, the society are very, very jittery when you start raising money for other purposes. I mean, it's got to go for the preaching work. But to cut a long story very short, from that one meeting, we set up a cell saver committee. And for about 10 years all over the country, there were actually millions of pounds raised amongst Jehovah's Witnesses to buy cell saver machines. It went all over the country. So if there was one thing that I could say I'm proud of, was that, I suppose, that we at least did something, I suppose, practical, if you to save lives. And I think now most hospitals have a cell saver machine, and they use them on everyone, not just Jehovah's Witnesses anyway.
I'm surprised the Witnesses didn't use the fundraising as an opportunity for more publicity for themselves.
Well, I think because it was done by us and was seen to be a private thing, the society as such, the official JW arm, didn't get involved because they knew about it at arm's length. And try to control it to a degree, but because it was a private matter, didn't allow it to be misused. Perhaps it was in some areas, I don't know. But we were only concerned that we wanted to make sure that these machines got out there. And I'd have to say the cooperation with the people that make the machines, I mean, I know they would say this, wouldn't they, because we're buying their machines, but they were so cooperative. You know, worldly people can be quite nice.
They can be.
I know
lovely.
You might find that a bit of a surprise. They can be quite nice. Yeah. But it was a great, I have to say, that was a great privilege and a great thrill to be part of that hospital liaison committee. But of course, I see it from another side now. I accept that, you know, there are many people that have suffered terribly because of the situation.
John, did you ever feel, as part of the hospital liaison committee, and I know you were a witness, so it's from a different side of the fence.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel that if someone was in hospital, a witness, facing the blood issue, that you were more enforcing the party line and making sure that they didn't divert?
I know what you're asking. I'm trying to honestly think. I can only speak for the Cardiff HLC.
Yes.
I'm confident that we didn't try to push people into certain decisions.
Did you warn them of the consequences if they allowed blood transfusions? Please don't think I'm picking on you on this question.
No. I understand why you're asking that.
The same sister that I'd mentioned earlier, when she was 12, she was hit by a car, and the hospital liaison committees had just come about then. They weren't even a year old, and I mean, obviously they were very fledgling. Maybe they had changed by the point that you were doing them. But certainly from my parents' memory and perspective, their sole job was basically man the defences, keep an elder at them at all times and tell the doctors to stay clear with blood and threaten my parents. I certainly know that from our experience that it was a stick and a stick approach.
Yeah, perhaps it was. That isn't my recollection, but that doesn't mean to say that that didn't happen. We used to go around, again, it was a local initiative that we decided we would go around on a Saturday evening and put on a presentation. So for many years, in South Wales at least, we would go to various congregations when invited. And for about 2 hours, hour and a half, we would put on a presentation about blood. Why don't we want blood? What can you do instead of blood? Are you sure you don't want blood? Why don't you want blood? So we tried to encourage people to sort of make a decision. But of course, that decision we wanted was don't take blood.
Yeah.
So that all the arguments were going to be faced that way, weren't they? I can't honestly say that I witnessed or was part of any pressure to put pressure on anyone. In other words, we never went to the bedside of someone who was sick to say, now you do realise that if you have a blood transfusion, the elders could disfellowship you. You know that, don't you?
Mm.
I mean, now that would be stupid to do, but I never witnessed that. In fact,
I can tell you that the chap who basically policed my sister's near-death experience.
Yeah.
I'll not name him because he's still alive, but the chap that did that is still alive. And about 6 years ago, he was actually caught and forcibly removed by security from my local hospital because he broke into their blood supply section and claimed that as a member of the HLC, he was entitled to inspect.
No. I'm sorry, I'm laughing, Neil, because it's not a laughing matter.
I know. I don't know if this is true because my brother's fiance, they live in Australia now, but she actually worked in the hospital, and she was there when he got caught. And and the only reason that they didn't have him arrested is because it would have looked so bad that he had gotten so far through their security.
Oh, right.
He at the time, I think now he's too old to be an elder because there's a retirement level, but at the time he was still the head of the HLC.
Well, it sounds as if they've got some, you'll excuse the expression, nutcases, but I think...
we have a few.
I'm sure. I mean, we used to sort of take the other line. We would say to doctors, look, whilst we don't want blood, we are not activists. So, for instance, if we see a blood van coming along, we're not going to throw ourselves under the wheels of a blood van to prevent it getting to the hospital. So we used to take that approach, and it has come back to me now as well that if ever we thought that someone might be wavering and was going to accept blood, we would withdraw because
That's
we didn't want to be part, either to be seen to be influencing them or actually to be aware of what they were going to do. It was their personal decision. Again, I'm probably coming across as a real goody-goody here, but I don't mean that. we tried to do the right thing, but I'm sure that there are cases and listeners will be able to say, oh, that didn't happen to me or that didn't happen to my uncle or whatever. For me, it was a very positive period of my Jehovah's Witness history, if I could put it like that.
I feel, as with all fascist regimes, that there are genuine people trying to do the right thing, and then there are other people who just go off list and do what they think.
Yeah.
And that might not be the party line, but there's nothing stopping them. So I think that what you've said, John, both situations can coexist, that there can be genuine people who withdraw at the right time when they see things are going wrong. And there can be other people, like you said, Neil, who plough in there and start interfering. And there's no real party line that says you must do this or you must do that. It's kind of, it's a bit like Hitler's fascist regime, where you can kind of do what you want based on what you believe. But the thing that interests me, John, is bringing it right up to date, which I appreciate is 15 years after you've left, is this case of Eloise Dupuis in Canada, who was age 26 and died in childbirth because she refused a blood transfusion. And it sounds like the shit's going to hit the fan, because Auntie is saying that she doesn't think that the girl gave consent, and other people are saying that she did. And I just think there's going to be a big investigation into this case, because she looks like a lovely, lovely, happy lady with a big bump. I'm looking at the picture now, smiling, happy, yeah. Genuine Jehovah's Witness who died in childbirth. And I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that anyone stood by her bedside and kind of convinced her against her will, but I think there is a question over whether she made an informed decision. I think there's going to be an investigation about this issue of informed decision. And that's difficult, because when I was a Jehovah's Witness, I would have insisted left, right and centre that it was my decision and nobody else's that I refused blood. And now that I'm not a witness, I'd insist left, right and centre that I was being mentally manipulated to refuse blood. And that
absolutely.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is difficult. I have to say, I don't know. I did quickly read over it. It was a very quick review, so I don't know the details.
Very
of,
short article, what happened. Yeah.
I just remember, and I know that when we were on the hospital liaison committee, that situation was the most potentially dangerous that you could have as a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
A mother who has just given birth.
Yeah.
If I remember rightly, I think it's called postpartum hemorrhage. It's a female gives birth just soon after. The possibility of massive hemorrhage is catastrophic. And if you're a Jehovah's Witness, it's bad enough if you're not a Jehovah's Witness, but if you're a Jehovah's Witness, it's very, very difficult. So I know that the pregnant Jehovah's Witnesses were being targeted by hospital liaison committees in a nice way to say, look, you are the most potentially dangerous situation. So make sure that you know, the doctor knows what your situation is. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
You know what was interesting? When I first graduated from university with my law degree, my first job was in the Legal Aid Board in the Southwest somewhere. And of course, I had access to all the legal aid files of everyone. And for the first 6 weeks, my job was just filing in the filing department. And as I was filing one day, I came across the files of a Jehovah's Witness lady. But I found out that this person had had a blood transfusion. I mean, I would have been sacked. It wasn't my place to say, and so I didn't say, but it just was the beginnings of me thinking, you know, not all Jehovah's Witnesses follow the rules. And actually, I was glad that she had, because it had enabled her to live and look after her children. And it was a bit of an eye-opener. Yeah. It was interesting. It was a bit of an eye-opener.
That's interesting. It's interesting.
But of course, as a Jehovah's Witness, you had no right. You had no right to not tell the elders. You're obliged to tell the elders.
Absolutely.
That.
You know, I was employed. Yeah. It's like signing the Official Secrets Act. What you learn at work, like, what I know about my students at school, I'm not allowed to tell you the names, the addresses, the birthdays, anything of my students. That's how it is. So it was.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the Jehovah's Witnesses don't accept that.
No.
The Jehovah's Witnesses. If you were an active witness at the time, your duty and obligation would have been to report her to the elders. You were actually breaking the rules by not reporting her, whether or not it would have destroyed your career.
Absolutely, which I was an active witness at the time, and I did, because to me, having just done 3 years of a law degree, I understood the ethics and the legality of the situation more than they understood this bloody kangaroo court of a window cleaner, a bloody plumber and a bloody street sweeper. Having
not so much of these window cleaners.
It was more the plumbers. It was the plumbers and the street sweepers that I was worried about, John.
That's right. I was just wondering, Louise, do you think you might have put your eternal salvation in peril then because of not acting according to the right way?
Quite possibly. And I'll tell you another funny story about that same situation. It was the Legal Aid Board, and I'd only been there a few weeks. And there was this horrible new manager that had come, and he had this awful patronising way about him, and he smarmed and he patronised. And he talked to me like I was a three-year-old. And one day I went into the staff kitchen and somebody, the manager, had left a report in the kitchen, and it was saying, why are so many people off sick in the admin department? And I just spent about 4 weeks filing in the admin department, and I wrote on there in pen, have you ever tried working in the admin department? It's bloody boring. That's why so many people are off sick. And then I ran out of the staff kitchen as fast as I could, so nobody would know it was me.
Oh, dear.
Oh, man.
You saying that, Louise, reminded me of, I think it was an Awake article. You may remember it, Neil. It's got to be 30 years ago, but it gave the example of, I think, someone called Mary, who worked in a hospital. This is an anonymous Mary.
Okay.
Who worked in a hospital and saw that someone had had a blood transfusion. And
yeah.
Faced with your situation or your scenario, Louise,
yeah.
she had to go and see the sister and say, look, basically, if you don't go and tell the elders, I've got to.
You fess up, I'll give you a week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So as Neil said earlier.
I think Raymond Franz used that story in his book.
Incidentally, if you get hold of that article, and I can't recall the footnote now, but if you ever get a chance to look at that article, it has a footnote from a Bible commentary that absolutely castigates anyone that doesn't go to court to give evidence against a guilty person.
Really?
I'm combining lots of arguments here. There was a discussion on Facebook about it a couple of months ago. You need to look it up. I can't explain it properly. But when you look at this footnote, the society are quoting this footnote to prove that Mary is within her rights, basically, to shop her sister. But the footnote of this Bible commentary says, basically, yes, if you know something, you should go to a court of law with witnesses and testify. Well, they don't do that when it comes to child abuse.
No, funnily enough.
So they're quoting it that you've got to do it when you can shop someone,
but not when you can support a child.
You have the opportunity of going to court. Yeah, the footnote is absolutely damning if you read it.
Wow.
I'm sorry, I can't quote it because I didn't know I was going to be talking about it.
Well, that's okay. The only other thing that I wanted to discuss tonight was this case that's come up on the internet of a woman who's suing the Jehovah's Witness Church in Weber County, I'm guessing this is America, because the witnesses made her listen to a recording of her own rape. I don't know if you saw that. Yes, it is Salt Lake City.
I didn't see that.
Oh.
Absolutely horrific.
My.
Stopping at points along the way sounded like she was complying with it or not.
Yeah, that's right. That's why they made her listen to it, to see if she was consenting to her own rape or not.
Yeah.
Can I ask, because I haven't heard this.
Yes.
I mean, how on earth did this get recorded? Do you know? I mean, was the sicko who did it?
I think it was. So it started off where, I mean, I think she was quite young, about 13. He was a witness. So it said the girl's interactions with the instructor, so he's obviously like an elder or a ministerial servant, began in summer 2007 when she attended a movie with him. And when driving home from the theatre, he took her phone off her, told her that she had to kiss him to get her phone back. And when she refused, he kicked her out of the car and drove off. And then he came back. And then after that, he had more interactions with her where he tied her up and left her in the car. He covered her head with a pillowcase. He did all sorts of perverted things. And I think as part of all those things, he recorded it.
I think possibly maybe the sat-nav recorded it or something like that.
Right.
I wonder if he had an in-car camera or something like that that was recorded.
Yeah, mine does that.
Does it?
Yeah.
Well, obviously not me assaulting women.
No.
Records the inside of the car 32 hours. Through the memory of my one, it usually is just me shouting at the kids. So it makes me feel like a terrible father.
Yeah.
So do I understand then, Louise, that this lady has... is taking the matter to court or her family?
Yes, I think she. Good. Yeah, she's taking it to court. And let me see, it says she's asking for a jury trial. She's asking for damages in excess of $300,000 to cover medical care, lawyer's fees and general damage. She's suing over intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligence and failure to warn. So she's suing the congregation, not the individual who abused her.
Right. That was one of the, you know, as an elder, if you ever had to handle something where some immorality had taken place, I know it does sound sick, but the idea was you had to sort of find out how serious was it in order to work out whether in Greek porneia had been committed. You get used to hear this word a lot.
Porneia. I remember that, yeah.
And so you'd have to ask questions that appeared, and I'm sure some of the elders, I'm sure some of them were sick and got a lot of, you know, they got off on it. But one of the most embarrassing, and I don't even know if I should tell you this one, one of the most embarrassing moments in my elder life was going to the Kingdom Hall and being the chairman of a judicial committee where a young lady had done something immoral with a young man involving oral sex. But we were trying to find out, like, what had happened, just so we knew whether porneia. And again, I can assure you, I wasn't doing it for sexual kicks. It was just trying to find that information. But you could hear a pin drop in the room, right? I want you to imagine this. You're trying to ask this young lady questions, and we were sitting on plastic chairs, and through the nervousness of it, I involuntarily passed wind. That made the worst sound you could possibly. It was like, I'm not making light of what this poor young lady went through, but that was what happened, and I thought, oh my goodness, I would like to have been removed from the room. And because of the makeup of the plastic chair, it seemed to reverberate.
The problem is the system. You know, you shouldn't have been put in that position either.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I don't look back on those times with any sort of pride. We did it because I was in a cult.
One thing that I find quite difficult, certainly as a parent, I don't know how you guys feel about this, but once I left the witnesses, when I was a witness, I had a philosophy and a system through which, you know, to live, and that I was content, what I believed, that I was going to teach my kids that. And once I left the witnesses, I found it very difficult to decide what rules I was going to follow, or, you know, what I was going to teach my kids to think. You know, I found it quite difficult.
I totally found that, because I left when my first child was a baby, and I hadn't woken up at that point. I'd left, but I just thought, well, that's it. My daughter's gonna become a drug addict and a prostitute because I've got no morals to guide her by now.
Absolutely.
And as I kind of felt my way tentatively through parenting on my own, because I'd just got divorced as well, by the time Chloe was 8, she was an atheist, and she had the most strict moral and ethical code of her own. She used to make me go and stand in a corner and be ashamed of what I said, because she was just so... I just used to think, wow, where has this child come from? And then my son, Joseph, 10 years later, he's just coming up to 9 now. He, of his own accord, has chosen to be an atheist. And I talk about God and creation and being blessed and blessings and gratitude. I've not influenced him either way, but both children decided round about the age of 8 that they were atheists. You know, Joe's a boy, so obviously he's not ethical or moral at all. But Chloe was. And I'm really proud of them. She's not a prostitute or a drug addict, as it turns out. She's like Safi or Fab Fab, and I'm like some naughty kind of childish teenager.
I think that's the biggest shock, a nice shock for those of us that have left as witnesses, is that you wait for the onslaught of worldliness.
It doesn't come.
Actually, there is no onslaught of worldliness. In fact, you start mixing with people who frankly have got better morals than a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses have.
Absolutely.
So that was, I think, probably the biggest surprise for me was that people in general are very nice, good, loving people.
Yeah,
and not the type of people that we are told that the world is.
No.
I think we know that you're more likely to be abused if you're a Jehovah's Witness child than you are a non-Jehovah's Witness child.
I think the problem, though, that we face now is that I don't know how you guys, you know, if you still have any interactions with Jehovah's Witnesses. I still have some, but I remember about 2 years ago, up until I left, when I left the Jehovah's Witnesses, I kind of left in a bit of a flash. You know, I sent my dissociation letter to Brooklyn and made it clear that I thought it was rubbish. And that was it. I packed it in and no one ever spoke to me. I didn't get a visit. Not once did I get a visit. Well, about 2.5 years ago, I took a job as a prison officer. And I was a prison officer in a very high security prison over here. And I was, it ended badly for me. I was very badly assaulted. I did not enjoy the whole experience. But whilst I was off work recovering from that, I saw a witness and I mentioned to them what had happened. And they obviously decided, the world finally got to him. Because after that, during that period of time, I had about 3 different witnesses who'd obviously heard, who then tried to use this as an attempt to woo me back.
Leverage.
Because obviously, you know, I had, you know, surely I must see the error of my ways now and ask me when I was going to come back to the meeting. And I never put 2 and 2 together until I realized that what they were actually doing is they had decided that, you know, that the world had finally spat me out and now it was time for me to come home.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if now, once you leave the Jehovah's Witness, you're not allowed to run a bad luck. You have to be successful and happy for the rest of your life with no negative times at all, or else, you proved them right. Mm. They were right all along.
I see a lot.
Yeah,
of
except that Jehovah's Witnesses have got a cover story, because when it happens to them, it's Satan.
Yes, because my
that's a very good point. Satan's wicked world.
Because my friend Abigail sent me a recorded talk recently, within the last week or two, of somebody who'd gone to a congregation in America and given this talk to say all about depression, and that, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses do suffer from depression, and it's because we're living in Satan's world. So they've got a total cover for that now, because the whole mental issue thing that we talked about last week, about how Jehovah's Witnesses suffer all these mental issue problems. Oh no, they've got a cover for that. Well, it's Satan's world. So that's the talk basically said Jehovah's Witnesses have to expect to be depressed because of Satan's world. Now, how terrible is that? Because actually, you know, you don't have to expect to be depressed. And, you know, depression happens, but it's not inevitable. It's not guaranteed. It's as guaranteed as breaking a leg. It happens for some. It doesn't happen for others. It can be avoided or it can be not avoided if it's an accident. But to kind of tell witnesses, just knuckle down to it, because you're all going to be depressed because Satan's system. It's a terrible message.
That's another control mechanism, though, isn't it, Louise?
Don't look for any help. Don't try and cure it. Just accept. Just get used to it. Knuckle down to it. It's like telling somebody with arthritis, "Oh, there's nothing you can do now. That's it. You've got it forever." Yeah. And that's not necessarily true. Some people can alleviate it with diet. Some people can alleviate it with medicine. Some people won't alleviate it. But don't mean to say you haven't got to try.
Quite right.
So, John, before we wind this up, have you got any other really juicy stories that you want to tell us?
Oh, let me think. Do you know what? Because I had such trouble trying to get on Skype to make this work, and it only sort of worked 5 minutes before we actually went on air, if you like, I wanted to spend time thinking about some of the things that happened, and I couldn't. But so I can't think of anything now.
Well, that's fine. In the absence of that, I'm just going to talk about your lovely sister, who I adore more than anyone else in Wales. And I feel like she's my suffragette sister, and she's strong and powerful, and she's an activist. And if we'd been born 100 years ago, we would have been out there, we're wearing the sashes, we're fighting the good fight.
Yeah.
And she's truly a wonderful person, Alison, isn't she?
She really is. It was difficult, because going back to our situation with my daughter being abused, at one time, Alison was very anti me because I was seen as the troublemaker, and she was a very good Jehovah's, another very, yeah. very good Jehovah's Witness family. And it divides families. Child abuse actually divides families. So I don't blame her at all. And she's apologised since.
And also, Alison was a victim as well, wasn't she? Alice, you know, Alison's had her own.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Situation yeah. with abuse as well, and the whole thing is utterly divisive, and confusing, and hurtful. And to be honest, the fact that you've all managed to remain with your husbands and wives is testament to how strong you are. Because for most people, what you and Alison have been through would, without a doubt, have caused divorce.
Yeah, I think that's right, and it has done to some people. No, yeah. we had last year. We went to Centre Parks in Nottingham, and we took my mum, who's 90, who's now out as well.
Wow.
There were 29 of us, all family members. We got this beautiful picture that has been taken of my mum in the middle, and 29 daughters, son, you know, grandsons, yeah. in-laws. So we are so thankful. And, you know, I am so thankful, Louise, because, you know, reading some of the terribly terrible horror stories that some of our poor dear friends have, where they're on their own, we are very, very lucky that we've got one another. And I'm so grateful to have Alison as a sister who's very positive.
You're actually an amazing family because you have all pulled together. Because we interviewed Karen on the podcast quite early on, very early on in the show. And that's how I got to know your family, because I didn't realise I lived so close to Karen. And I said, oh, come over and meet you. And that's how I've kind of become part of your family. And I wish I was a family member of your family, because you're a lovely group of people. And the fact that you've all managed to overcome that is incredible. It's just been a tough, tough path for you all, hasn't it?
It has. And of course, I've got my other daughter, Catherine, my middle daughter, who went through hell, really. She didn't get abused, but the fallout from it.
Yeah.
And she eventually, you know, she was one of these that were baptized at 13 yeah. and then by 16 had to leave. And we threw her out, basically. Mm. She too has been through such difficulties that Mary and I often say that our girls have the right to disfellowship us. Oh. They have the right to say, you're not being part of our family anymore. You're disgusting the way you treated us. And we're so thankful that, you know, they haven't taken that attitude. So you're right. We are close as a family now, but it could have been so different.
You had an amazing holiday in America, didn't you, with Karen and her husband? Just recently.
Yes, we did. Yeah. Although I must tell her, I don't know how much time we've got.
Go on.
We went to the White House. We went to Washington, and I went to the White House, and it's all closed off to traffic.
Yeah.
And it's like a semicircle outside the White House, and we're taking pictures of the White House itself. And who should be there? Both ends of this semicircle, the carts.
No.
And do you know what? I was so incensed. I don't normally get incensed. And I said to Mary, I'm just going to go over and have a little chat with them. And she said, don't go over. Don't go speak to them. And I said, no, I want to. I want to go over and speak to them. So I made my way over to the first cart, pretended to look at the magazines. They don't approach you.
No.
And I just said, there's something I've always been interested in about Jehovah's Witnesses and their beliefs. Can I ask you? I said that if Armageddon had come 40 years ago, then a million Jehovah's Witnesses would have been saved, but only sort of 1 or 2 billion people would have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. But as Armageddon is being put off, there might be a few hundred thousand Jehovah's Witnesses more going to be saved, but there's billions and billions of people, God's children, are going to have to be destroyed. So the longer it goes on, the more children of his he's going to have to destroy. What do you think about that? And happened was they took 2 steps back. They didn't say a word. They physically took 2 steps back. And so I looked at them and I said, perhaps I haven't described it well. And I went through the whole thing again. What I'm saying is this. If Armageddon was going, and I told the whole story again, and she took another step back. And I was incensed. And I said, can I ask you? I said, why have you actually taken 2 or 3 steps back since the time I asked you that first question? And she just Well, they didn't speak. They just wouldn't speak. The only thing she said was, like, are you an apostate? And I said, no, I'm not an apostate. No, but it's something I've always worried about. And then, this is the funny bit, Mary came up to me, grabbed me by the arm and said, come away, I told you it was useless. And then a Secret Service security guy with the sunglasses tapped me and said, do what your wife says, man. He said, just come away. And Mary had been talking to the Secret Service guy outside the White House and telling her all about our experience. And so he'd come up to say, look, you're wasting your time, just come away. So even outside the White House, you've got the carts doing their damage.
Right. My wife was there last year, and she saw them there too.
Yeah.
Did she? Well, is your wife an ex-JW, Neil?
My wife? No, she's not. We met about a year after I quit going to the meeting. But my daughter was luckily involved in a little movie, mm-hmm. and she got a trip to America to go to the premiere of it in LA. And as they flew to America, they stopped off and took a White House trip. So she took some pictures for me, and she always encourages me to come and harass the witnesses whenever I see them.
When I went to Lincoln to visit my daughter at university a few weeks ago, the witnesses were there under the arch, and my daughter, as we walked past them, my daughter was going, "Don't say anything! Don't say anything! Don't say anything! Don't say anything!"
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to say anything.
Sometimes you feel like it and sometimes you don't.
So. Yeah, I wouldn't embarrass anyone that was my family who had never been a witness. No. But if I'd been on my own, no. I might have said something.
Well,
I have found that they are completely dead.
Yeah.
Behind the eyes, a good friend of mine just recently, another ex-elder in our congregation, my best friend, described it like this. It's like as if you've had the top of your head lifted up. When you're a Jehovah's Witness, they remove some of the wires and some of the brain, and they put the head back, and you cannot then make a connection. You can only connect the Jehovah's Witness thinking, and that's what it's like when you're talking to these people. It's as if there's nothing going on behind. Yeah. They smile, but they're absolutely dead,
like a frontal lobotomy.
It is, and I know I won't waste my time anymore trying to reason with them, because you can't.
Well, if I can make one more, can I make one more point before I go to bed?
Please, yeah.
It's something you just said there made me think. I was at there was a festival in Belfast this summer. It was called the Cumela, and it's basically a big multicultural food event with music. And I take my kids there every year. And this year, particularly, the Jehovah's Witnesses were all over it. They were all outside. There was sitting about 12 different carts, and they were all handing out different language brochures and tracts. And I saw a few witnesses that I used to be very good friends with. I mean, people that I would have genuinely felt, you know, like a family with. And I saw one of them, who's a chap, you know, I still talk to now, called Roddy Moore. And I saw Roddy. And this is the funny thing. It's because back when you're a witness, you assume that the position of an elder is something important. And I saw Roddy, he's been an elder now for 25 years, and I gave him a wave, but he was with the circuit overseer. And he looked at me, and he shunned me, and turned around and ignored me. And I thought, oh, okay, Roddy's shunning me now. And, you know, I saw him 2 weeks ago in Lisburn, where I live, and he, of course, the circuit overseer was not with him. He was out window cleaning, and I stopped, and we talked for about 25 minutes. And I thought to myself at the time, you know, you're exactly right. It's like they've taken something out of their head. But it's also like their children. You know, he's supposed to be this mature man in a responsible position. But really, he's just a kid who's scared of annoying the higher-up teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's pathetic, but, you know, that's life.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for your time. And Neil, in the interest of balance, I have something here. My partner went to America over summer, and he brought me back a few presents from America. And one of them was a tin of peppermints. And on the front, it says, Monica Lewinsky's ex-boyfriend's wife for president.
Oh, you are incorrigible.
So on that bombshell.
I say we got through this without mentioning Donald Trump once.
And we did. We were epic.
Get on the Trump train, Louise.
Look, my son is 9, and he has said, how can a man be named after a fart, mummy?
you're aware that he wasn't originally called Trump.
No, I wasn't. What was he called?
His family moved from Europe about 80 years ago, and they were originally called Drumpf. D-R-U-M-P-F, I think it was. And they were called Drumpf, and they decided what name to call themselves. They actually contemplated calling themselves Kennedy, but they changed their mind and they called themselves Trump at the end. It was a bit little close to what they were called. So that's just his new family name. A bit like the Queen.
Okay.
You know, it's called Saxo Gothenburg or whatever.
Okay.
And people thought, that sounds a bit German to me. Let's call her Windsor.
And on that bombshell. Thank you so much, Neil, for dragging yourself out of hospital to do a 5-hour long podcast. We massively appreciate it. Is there anything that
I did the Vast Apostate Hour about 2 months ago,
yeah.
And I did that in the hospital lift shop because my dad was getting a bone marrow transplant.
Oh no!
So I had to put out of his ward, out of his visitors' room, and then I did the show there. So I'm getting used to it.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Well, I hope that the next podcast we do, you're not anywhere near or in or around a hospital or an emergency theatre of any kind.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. And John, thank you so much for coming on and being our guest today. It's been absolutely riveting. And I know that you've got about 1,000 more stories, and I'm sure we'll have you on again to hear the other 998.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Fun. Say goodbye, Neil.
Goodbye, Neil.
Say goodbye, John.
And goodbye to all of you.
Thank you so much. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to our show, and remember to share the love and spread the word about JW Podcast.